about government, music, art, health, science, ecology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence of Prince, Don Nikoloff.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next 2 hours. We have a wonderful guest on tonight. Before we bring him on board, I want to personally thank Dr. Len Horowitz and Reverend Roxy Hampton for acknowledging the show and asking everyone to hang in there and listen to the show. It's going to be very interesting tonight. This is going to be, an event where we provide some solutions and talk to you about some things that we can do to empower ourselves individually and then collectively. A few points I want to bring up. My email has been going crazy since first thing this morning, actually even before I woke up. These days I'm lucky enough to get a couple of hours of sleep every night. There's a lot going on with this issue of Barack Obama's certificate of live birth. And, of course, we have yet to see one anywhere. And according to africanpress.wordpress.com, there is a fourth lawsuit that has been filed by Andy Martin, a journalist who paid the fee to get a copy of Obama's certificate of live birth from the state of Hawaii. Was reported in a couple of places that Obama has been in Hawaii supposedly taking care of his not-so-well grandmother, when in reality it's most likely that he is trying to get the governor and the secretary of the Department of Health to obfuscate this issue of the birth certificate. Now, I have a copy of the complaint as it's filed against Linda Hingle, who is the governor of the state of Hawaii, and a Dr. Kiyome, and there is a name missing. It's blanked out. Evidently, that is under discovery. But the case is now the fourth such one which has been filed in the United States. There is also the first one that was filed by attorney Phil Berg in Philadelphia. I spoke to Mr. Berg about 2 months ago in regards to this, and I told him he is correct in filing this lawsuit, that my research and my evidence shows that Obama cannot give us any firm indication that he was born in the United States of America. I also pointed out to Mr. Berg that such is the case with John McCain, and I had a listener, Mary, email me an article regarding the U.S. Senate's vote and determination to give John McCain the go-ahead to run as a U.S. citizen. Now, if John McCain was a U.S. citizen, why would the Senate need to do that? I am a U.S. citizen, and most likely everyone listening to this show in the United States is a U.S. citizen. We don't have to have the Senate declare us citizens. So I find it kind of ironic that they would have to do that, that somehow they would have to pass a law or a bill through the Senate declaring McCain eligible to run. It sounds like, much like the bailout, that this was done under threat of martial law, or who knows what other types of blackmail or extortion may have gone on behind the scenes. My best recollection is that on Friday, April the 18th, they actually had a secret meeting in the Senate. Someone had brought that to my attention that evening, and I recall talking about it on that evening's broadcast. And the first article came out through the Washington Post on May the 2nd. So it took several weeks for that information to get out. And, of course, the mainstream media has said nothing, although you hear them talk about McCain having provided his birth certificate. And I'm telling you that a hospital that was not built 5 years and even 6 or 7 years after McCain was supposedly born at Cocosolo Naval Base Hospital indicates very clearly that he is not an American. Also, the research I did on his father and his grandfather clearly show that they were implanted into, as agents, into the U.S. Navy, that they were not American citizens either. And I don't care that they were with the Navy, they were not U.S. citizens. It's as simple as that. And so neither one is really qualified to run for the office of the presidency. When we get into Hillary Clinton's background, you're going to see the same thing. I guarantee you, you will see exactly the same thing. So, and that is going to be part three of the Three Stooges Go to Washington. That said, if you would like to read the specific lawsuit that Andy Martin filed in the state of Hawaii, go to africanpress.wordpress.com. And I'll give you the rest of the URL, /2008/10/19/ Obama's, that's O-B-A-M-A-S, -citizenship-questioned-laws. And that should take you there. Or just go to the africanpress.wordpress.com website. With that, I would also like to mention that attorney Phil Byrd today told an acquaintance of mine that he is taking his case now to the Supreme Court, that Obama's people did not answer the lawsuit within the specified amount of time. In fact, as I understand the law, that is an admission of guilt. Nonetheless, we will talk about that with tonight's guest. He is an attorney. And he is an activist in empowering us on a local level. We're going to talk about a few of his many websites, as well as some of the things that he is doing to help Americans across the country turn things around for the better. With that, I welcome back to Evident Footprints my good friend, Carl Pearson. Carl, good evening. How are you?
John, hi. Very good, thank you. Been a long day. I've had 8 hours of depositions, like you're locked in a room for 8 hours listening to a lawyer drone on and on and on. God almighty. I hate those depositions. You just don't understand what it's like to be locked in a room for 8 hours.
Well, I've been in one before, so I know a little bit about it. Now, I'm not the attorney that you are. Hopefully, I explained this case in layman's terms in a manner that someone could understand it. But I think it's coincidental that you're on the show tonight. And if you would be so kind, I know that this is not the reason you came on the show, but could we talk about this issue of citizenship
Sure.
for a few minutes?
Sure. I have an immediate comment on Philip Berg's, the way you described it. It sounds as if the complaint had been filed, a summons allegedly had been served, and I say allegedly because if there wasn't proper service, then the failure to answer the complaint would not ultimately create liability. There would be no right to have a judgment if there wasn't proper service.
Mm-hmm.
But the judge wouldn't know that because the one who files a complaint has a process server that says, oh yeah, I served the person. So they file a default judgment saying that the process server duly served so-and-so who I believe is so-and-so. And then they get a default judgment. And at that point, the default judgment would be to order the Secretary of State to produce whatever documents were sought. after in that complaint. But if the service was not proper, the other side might have taken the position, let's not even bother to answer, because by the time we're required to do anything, the election will be over. It'll be too late anyway, so let's not bother to answer. Let him do whatever he wants to do. So it sounds like there's some kind of alleged default here and an effort to enforce it and the failure of the court to enforce it, and he's probably going up on appeal somewhere in that area of the failure to enforce a default judgment.
Well, my understanding, and I understand that is perfectly correct. My understanding of the first phase of the lawsuit is that the judge had already ordered Obama to produce three documents. One, the birth certificate. Two, a document that he had been naturalized as a U.S. citizen because of the time that he had spent out of the country. And, of course, there is an alleged birth certificate in Kenya, another one in Indonesia, a third one in British Columbia, and, of course, Obama claims there's one in Hawaii. Why not produce it? It seems like the easiest, simplest thing to make this go away.
But let me ask, who was the named defendant in the case? Is it Obama, or is it a keeper of records, or is it both?
Oh, in that case, it was Obama. Phil Burke has expanded this to the Democratic National Committee. He's filed a suit against them detailing a number of torts and statements that they have made in regard to Obama's failure to produce these documents and enable the Democratic National Committee to make the determination that they can legally present him as a bona fide candidate for the party. So this is now, and I think there were at least 26 statements of fact that he had added to this whole thing.
Can you see a process server coming up, getting set to accost Obama with all of the Secret Service people surrounding him? That process server wouldn't stand a chance of delivering any process personally to Obama. I remember about four years ago, I had a petition and I wanted to sort of serve the petition. Yeah, I was suing Giuliani is what happened. And I had the complaint in my hand. And then, lo and behold, Giuliani was down near federal court, and he was surrounded by a bunch of bodyguards. So I went up to Giuliani, and I put my hands in the air to show that I'm not meaning him any harm. And I said, I have a document which is intended for you. I'd like you to take a look at it. So Giuliani told his bodyguards, about four or five of them, heavy New York detectives, big football players, he said, it's okay. So I handed him the paper. Not that it meant anything, but these people are well protected. It's hard to serve anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, yes, the issues are very interesting. And if I can see that a delaying tactic could be fatal, because it's conceivable that within the next 2 weeks there will be no implementation. There will be no opportunity to order anyone and to see to it that they produce it before the election. So that will be one thing. But then there is an issue up to the point of swearing in. If somebody truly is not qualified to be sworn in as president, I suppose that ultimately the Supreme Court is the person or the group that determines the qualification. I think the electors might be able to do something there. They could refuse to vote for somebody unqualified, but in the long run it would go up probably to the Supreme Court anyway. No matter what happens by the electors, certain states decide to throw their votes to someone else or to nobody, and there would be challenges. But it's a hell of a mess. It'd be one.
Yes, well, it's no different than the bailout, is it?
Oh, no, I mean, it's a hell of a mess. And, you know, the unfortunate thing is that we don't need to focus as a country on the mess at the top. You know, there's a way that we can really do a play work around that. And that was what I've been focusing on, trying to avoid the mess at the top, because we're all embroiled in it and we can't do very much about it. Philip Berg and Mr. Martin are trying to do something in their way, and the likelihood that people are going to prevail, any one individual is going to prevail at changing what's going on at the top, I don't think is very likely. There's too many institutions that are designed to protect the top. If somebody, the wrong person, wins an election, the Supreme Court can change the election, for example.
So which they did, I think, twice, didn't they, more or less?
So, you know, and it can happen again. So, to me, trying to get all worked up about something that every 4 years we have a chance to change things, I really have come to the realization over the years that all the excitement and the prospects for change that we see coming up in that election is just a lot of hype, and the change does not come about, at least not a good change.
Yes, that's true. Now, I'm inclined to agree with you. My purpose for bringing this up, of course, I'm not going to make any excuses for it, is because I have a certain duty to my listening audience to let them know that these things are going on, and it is falling in line with my research as well. I was on another show this afternoon with a gentleman out of Florida, Jerry Hughes, and I was revealing some of my research to him, and I said, aside from all the issues that are coming out, the main thing is neither of these two candidates have been able to, and I can say this clearly, on the basis of my research, there is no way they can produce a valid birth certificate because neither was born in this country. And I'm not even getting into the argument of whether or not Coco Solo is considered a part of American territory because we had a base there and John McCain's grandfather was the commander of that base. That is not the issue. The issue was he could not have been born in a hospital that didn't exist. So he was not born there, and he is not in the National Archive record of certificates of live birth for the year 1936 at the Panama Canal Coco Solo Naval Base.
Here's an issue just to try to raise one issue that will be raised in that matter. I think, and that is that the children of citizens who are on active duty outside the country, these children are automatically, I think by statute, they're granted the same privileges of citizenship as the parents have. It may not be a constitutional item, it may be a grant by statute, but I think that if his parents were citizens and they were the father, yeah, if they were living on active duty outside the country, it would seem to me that he would be a citizen for that reason. So, is there any evidence that the father and mother were not citizens?
Absolutely. The family ancestry is totally fraudulent. In fact, I identify John Sidney McCain Sr., who is the grandfather, as John McCann, the bastard son of Prince Albert Edward, who became Edward VII, the King of England.
Not the one we used to call up on and ask, you have Prince Albert in the can, and then they say, yes, they say, well, you better let him out before he suffocates.
Yeah, but if it was that Albert, I don't think it was regular pipe tobacco. and then it's the same thing. In fact, he was going under the name of John McCann, and he was traveling on a ship owned by the United States Lines. Teddy Roosevelt owned the line. He was a crew member on that for a number of years. and I found his name on the cruise list. He was born in Renfrew, Scotland, and it's just tremendous obfuscation. But I determined that Jenny Jerome, who ended up being the mother of Winston Churchill, would have been the mother. She had a long-going affair with Prince Albert Edward. Very, very interesting research. And the same with the father. In fact, the father, I believe, is the brother.
You know that there is a body, a governmental body in the United States that is allowed to issue certificates of birth to people that were not born in the United States. Did you hear of that agency?
Let me guess. Would that be the signing statement agency in the White House?
No, it's the United States Supreme Court.
Well,
they have the power by reason of being able to adjudicate litigation concerning any issues. They have the power to really, in effect, grant a birth certificate if they wish.
Well, it would be interesting to find out if they've ever done that.
Well, they don't have to say it. They just have to say denied, cert denied. That becomes, it's the wrong cert, but it's called certiorari, but
yes.
My certificate, but he may claim it means certificate granted, birth certificate granted. They have supreme power. I mean, they can do anything they want. It's political body.
Yes, yes, I understand that. Well, it's an issue worth delving into, and that those two points on each candidate are sufficient. All the rest of the stuff is just compounding of all the lies that are told.
Here's an interesting issue. If the electors go ahead and approve both either the winner, the winning team, and the electors somehow approve it. If the Supreme Court then should say that the president, that president-elect is not qualified, that would mean, I think, that the vice president-elect becomes the president, if I'm not mistaken. But I'm not sure if you have to have a swearing in before the vice president would be able to take over. I don't know that fine point of law.
Yeah, they may be banking on trying that. In either case.
Yeah, either way. We would have the issue of whether the vice president-elect takes over immediately on the disqualification or death of the president. If the president has not been sworn in, that would be interesting.
So basically now, we have, since 2001, we've been dealing with Osama bin Laden and now Obama Joe Biden.
Oh, what a mess. What a mess.
Yes.
But
well,
you know, part of this mess is that it keeps most of the United States focusing every night on the mess, and all the talking heads talk about the mess. But you know, they don't talk about the things that could be done. And that isn't that amazing that there are things that can be done, but oh my God, let's not talk about it, because then the terrible mess isn't as messy as one really is being led to believe.
Yes. Yes, that's so true. Sean Hannity did a show. In fact, I was alerted that he had read my research on Obama, and I presume on McCain, too. Evidently, he found my pictures to be very useful. It was as if I was watching all the pictures in my article, one after the other, being shown on Fox television.
With no attribution, I bet.
That's correct.
Yeah. you know that that's copyright infringement?
Well, I discussed that with my editor at the Idaho Observer, and he said, well, because it's out there on the internet, and you know, I got, these are not my original pictures, let's put it that way.
Okay.
You know, there, it's considered fair game because it's out on the internet. And, you know, I'll thank Mr. Hannity, for at least drawing attention to the pictures in my article.
No,
I would have liked to hear him talk about some of the things that I discovered, which totally, expose some really, really important issues, such as a child that was born in 2004. The child was born on Halloween night and died Christmas Day, 56 days after its birth. The child's name is Renee Abdena Obama. And it was born and died in the state of Maryland, and there's no listing for the parents. Now, who do you think the parents would be with a last name like Obama? What is interesting about this, three different sources, genealogical sources, list the name and list the date of birth, the date of death, and a social security number. Also, there is a property in Florida, a condominium in the name of this child, but the child's name has been altered to an alias. They take the O off of the last name and just use the name Bama. And Barack Obama is cryptically described in there, and I'm sure that's who it is, as Brian Bama. Now, he has the name David Bama, Paul Bama. It's part of the real estate money laundering scheme that they have going on the Internet. But it's a very, very revealing document, and it's listed under that name, Renee Bama.
Here's an interesting thing for you, and that is that even if you have, let's say, 5 or 10 photographs that are not protected, and they come from different sources, and they're in public domain, if somebody puts them all together into a meaningful story or meaningful scenario to
expose,
make a point,
yeah.
To make a point, that is an organization of intellectual property that is protected by the copyright laws. You could have that assembly be your copyrighted interest, that you created that assembly and they took that assembly from you. So you theoretically might have a copyright infringement action. Just I'm a copyright lawyer as well, so.
Okay, well, we can talk about that. I'll have you talk to my publishers.
This is the kind of sophistication that people in a town need, and a town generally doesn't have that. This is a Wall Street type of sophistication of why the different exotic financial instruments have been a fraud. I mean, it wasn't known about the existence of these instruments to most people in a small town. And even if they knew about it, they probably couldn't analyze how they were fraudulent.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a field of law that generally securities law has enough tools to be able to show you that those things are fraudulent. So in a small town, you don't have anyone that practices that kind of law. And because of that, the town is vulnerable to those organizations like banks, major retailers, and others who can take advantage of these laws and milk the town for more money than they should. And I try to do something about that. So that is where my concept of a town attorney general fits in, that the learning, the ability of an attorney general of a state really should be brought down to the level of the town, so that the people in the town and the merchants in the town, the homeowners, the taxpayers, the voters, the poor, the unemployed, the people without adequate medical care, can have somebody looking after their rights, their legal rights. They go unattended, whereas the big companies with all that power, the political and the legal power, can just wipe out a town. They take away the value of the town, and the town doesn't realize it. They think it's somehow just the way things work, but if you could just stand up to them, you can stop it, you can reverse it, and you can bring a town back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you and I have been talking about that and actually working on something there, but we're not at liberty to go into any details.
But it
does work, let's put it that way. I'll stand behind you there and let the listening audience know it does work. And we do have a recourse. Of course, it takes a sane mind. It takes someone who's actually interested in pursuing that and really seeing it for what it is. I wish I could say more right now.
Well, let's just talk about a town in Indiana, a hypothetical town in Indiana that has various problems. And let's focus on that little town. To the extent that we're going to talk about a town, we can think of as little town in Indiana.
Okay. Any name you want to give it? Indianapolis or something smaller?
How about the town of Hopeless?
Okay, Hopeless, Indiana. Okay.
Right.
All right.
And Hopeless, Indiana has all sorts of problems. They had a General Motors plant closed down that deprived the town of its main employer. Can a town that loses a plant like that, what are some of the legal issues that they might have? I mean, what kind of recourse does a town have? So, and this, by the way, the General Motors plant in Hopeless, of course, is mythical, and General Motors doesn't have a plant there because there is no Hopeless, Indiana. But if a town like Hopeless loses a General Motors plant, I would like to know whether General Motors had any dealings, any agreements with the town. Did the General Motors have their employees going into the town and taking advantage of medical care that General Motors probably should have financed themselves, but figured that now things are rough, let's let the workers apply for health care at public expense. And I think there's a claim that a person could make against a company, a major retailer that, for example, that tells its employees, look, we don't have the money. With all the billions of dollars we make each week, we don't have the money to pay for health care financing. We want the town to pay that. We want the town to clear the land on which we're going to build our monstrous retail outfit. We want the town to give us all the tax revenues for the next 10 years to help us pay all those things, all the benefits, all the subsidies that are taken out of the town. Number one, are crazy because they put the small merchant in the town out of business. And they're the ones who are paying the tax to put themselves out of business. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But if a company should leave and say, well, we have other places to go, then there's a concept called a clawback where the town or the county, maybe the state, would have a right to bring a suit to recover the monies that were, or the subsidies that were given, and for which the government did not receive the full benefit that was promised. So that's an area of law that's been developing for the past 10 or 15 years, and Good Jobs New York is the leading organization that follows that throughout the nation. Good Jobs New York, they follow that closely. I have a website on that, and I call it Job Theft. That's my subdirectory, Job Theft. And basically what we have in this country, and it's unfortunate, is that we have businesses selling jobs from one place to another, and they get huge subsidies to remove themselves from one town and plant themselves in another. And they stay, I guess, for a few years and then say, well, it's time to make another move again. The interesting thing is that there are no new jobs created except for movers. But there's no new jobs. And yet huge subsidies in the amount of billions of dollars are being given to these major corporations to play their dominoes, or not dominoes, but checkers. They move these things around the board, but there aren't any additional checker pieces. It's all the same checkers. It's just that they get paid to move them around and disrupt families and disrupt communities and cut off the revenues that communities counted on and were getting. And it's just, that's a crime as far as I'm concerned. They shouldn't be trading in human lives that way.
Mm-hmm.
It should be illegal, and I have a website on that, my job theft website, which goes into all this, the unfortunate trading of, it's a slave trading system in America, where they just take jobs and move them somewhere else so that the people in town can't follow. They have to stay here in the town, in hopeless Indiana. They stay in hopeless, whereas the jobs get moved to some other place. We should fight that, and we should bring a lawsuit against the people that do that. And I think that there are various doctrines that can be applied, like fraud, failure to state their true intention. They were deceiving us when they came into town and said that they were going to do such and such when they intended not to. We could allege fraud. We could allege this is what a lawyer would do, is to try to figure out the basis upon which the town could recover the damages caused by that.
Mm-hmm. You and I talked about this on a few past shows. It's worth bringing up again.
Yeah.
And I know specific instances, not just in hopeless Indiana, where companies like Walmart or Kmart come into town, and they convince the local, let's say, the city councilmen and the representatives, sometimes it's a mayor that's directly involved with these negotiations with these companies, and they threaten to go to the next little community outside. Let's say, in the case of hopeless Indiana, they would threaten to go to less than hopeless Indiana.
Right. Or more hopeless.
Yes. And set up the business there with this promise of, in a specific case I know of, where they promised 300 full-time jobs, including benefits. We're talking about 401k, profit sharing, or retirement packages, health care. And what they do to get around that is they schedule these people for 38 or 39 hours of work, knowing that if they're working 40 or more hours of work, then they're classified as full-time. Then they use that as an excuse for not giving them the health benefits. They usually get a 10-year or more tax abatement. And in many cases, and again, I know specifically that some of these big companies, two that I just mentioned, have actually convinced the local authorities to pay for the infrastructure costs that are involved, and that's the water lines, the access roads, the parking lots, sometimes the buildings themselves. And you know, this is fraud, definitely fraud. And because of the political pressure put on these people, they usually will not pursue it. And even when someone like myself goes before the city council and registers a complaint in public, in a public meeting, where, let's say, usually these are under federal programs, for example. The Federal Program Committee is meeting, and the Community Development Department is funneling money from the federal government into these projects. And if they go belly up, they just take off, and they usually tend to do that at the end of the tax abatement period, which is something what you're describing, although you didn't mention that specifically, but that's usually when they'll leave, when they have
Crystal
to start
City,
paying tax.
Walmart had a deal with Crystal City, California, and Crystal City was going to get all of the sales tax revenues after 7 years, I think it was, I'm guessing, I forget exactly. Exactly on the last day of the seventh year, the town is celebrating because now they start getting the money, and they spent a lot of money in anticipation of this revenue flow going to start at the end of the seventh year. On the last day of that seven-year period, Walmart packed up all of its stuff and left, and the town got nothing, and they filed for bankruptcy.
Hmm.
Crystal City, California, very famous for that.
Well, so you're saying these are things that even hopeless Indiana can fight, And
absolutely. All you need is an attorney that is familiar with things other than zoning. I mean, not everything other than zoning, but zoning is an important part of the economy for smaller towns like Hopeless. But the problems that they have go beyond zoning and they don't realize it. And there aren't any courts locally that handle that kind of problem. There aren't any attorneys earning a living with that kind of problem. The governmental official who does handle that kind of problem is in the state capitol.
Mm-hmm.
As the attorney general. And they're not going to be bothered with that small stuff. So you need somebody for the town. It's very important, but for a state like in New York, where you have 1,800 towns and villages and different municipalities and things, you can't be bothered with those minor things that are wiping out a town. You need to have the town focused on protecting itself and
yes.
worrying about itself. That's what you need. And that's what this concept of the town attorney general is, to be focused on helping the town. That's the only priority, is what we can do to help the town.
Now, in the instance where there's a union, for instance, I know that likely Hopeless Indiana would even have the union. I forget what their actual name is, but it's the one that represents the grocery store, department store workers, you know, the cashiers and the stock boys.
I forget I could look it up here, but their interest is not in eliminating Walmart. Their interest is in getting as good a deal for their employees as they can, so that you can travel with them up to a point, but then when they get their agreement, they no longer have any issues. And they're not really against Walmart, whereas I am, because Walmart destroys small businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And they
I would think their obligations, you know, the promises that they make to their constituents in the union, they have an obligation to force Walmart to comply with that agreement, separate from the city itself. I mean, they're representing the interest of the workers. The workers are paying dues, paying the salaries of these individuals and all the perks that they get that go along with it. You would think that there's some recourse there as well.
It's unlikely. There would be a major conflict. They don't want to force Walmart to leave. They really want to force Walmart to give as much as they can extract by having better working conditions and more benefits, higher wages, and things like that. That's their interest. And having achieved that, they no longer are there worrying about the small merchant outside who's being put out of business. The reason that a small merchant can't survive against the competition of a major retailer, and there's about 100 major retailers, the top two are Walmart and Home Depot. Those are absolutely the top two. But Walmart is a general store, whereas AutoZone and Home Depot are specialized retailers. So
mm-hmm.
Walmart and Kmart and are examples, but Walmart is by far number one. And you have a very successful model for Walmart, where Walmart externalizes as much of its costs as it can. It lays off the cost on other people, such as the town, the employees, the health maintenance service in the area, the towns and counties that are expecting revenues. They don't get them. Those revenues go to Walmart in many cases. The costs of bringing Walmart in, all of those are like allowing Walmart to open up for free. And then they impose costs on their manufacturers. They force the manufacturers to sell to them at a lower cost even than the manufacturer is expending to make the goods. They force the manufacturer to sell below cost, so that Walmart clearly has the lowest price around, because you can't sell to everyone below cost. You're required to sell to Walmart below cost, but the smaller merchants have to pay more.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. So they're forcing those merchants, their competition, basically, to pay more. And
go out of business.
Yes.
So that ever increasingly a higher percentage of the sales by a manufacturer to Walmart are to Walmart, and they are below cost. So the manufacturers drive themselves out of business. Then they're told, well, move your jobs overseas, and you can save some money for a while. So they do that. So we see that manufacturing in America was hollowing out because of they were being driven to that. There's a law in the United States that's been on the books since 1936. It's called the Robinson-Patman Act, and it's a little-known statute which is now becoming more prominent. And there's some argument or talk about by the industry regulated by it. Just last week, they said if Obama gets in, you can expect a resurgence in the Robinson-Patman Act. I'm probably the most experienced attorney in the country on the plaintiff side in Robinson-Patman Act cases because I've been doing it for a long time. And it's a dying field because antitrust is dead. The government isn't enforcing antitrust. And yet, the Robinson-Patman Act says that any manufacturer is not allowed to sell to competing resellers at different per unit prices, except where the volume to one, the savings from the volume of a major customer, is allowed to reduce the price, but only to the extent of the saving. So that doesn't justify selling below cost. There is no saving in selling below cost.
Yeah.
So as long as they're selling below cost, you know they're violating the Robinson-Patman Act, and it then becomes truly a Sherman Act problem. That's a monopolization and a conspiracy to restrain trade statute that most people have heard of, the Sherman Antitrust Act.
Mm-hmm.
So when you start selling below cost, you're driving people out of business. Unnecessarily, you are. And there's another statute that one could enforce. But the Robinson-Patman Act was designed to stop monopolies from achieving that status because if a company is required to sell to competitors at the same price, then the competitors are going to compete on the basis of quality and service. Price, if they buy at the same price, they can compete on the same price, and there you have quality and service. You know that service is lacking. You go to a store that has a very low price. They often don't have much service. The quality, I'm assuming, is the same if it's the same goods, so the quality drops out when the goods are the same.
Mm-hmm.
If the book, for example, if it were a record, if Walmart sells a record for 80 cents, a song for 80 cents, and another store sells it for $2. It's the same song, presumably on the same packaging and that, so that the quality is the same, but Walmart buys it for so much less that they can resell it for a lot less, and people will buy from those that sell it for the cheapest price. We need to have enforcement of the nation's Robinson-Patman Act to stop the growth of the major retailers that are in turn destroying the town. They're destroying Main Street in the town, and they've been getting away with it ever since Nixon. I've been tracking it. I've been in the business since then.
Mm-hmm.
I've been tracking how there's no enforcement starting with Nixon right up to the present. There's no enforcement. So my attorney general would be the town attorney general would become the Justice Department, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Attorney General, the FTC, the EEOC, the FDIC, all of these different governmental regulatory agencies have lawyers that do enforcement. A small town could use one lawyer to do that enforcement, and that lawyer would be enforcing the rights of the people in the town as well as the town, and it would be for the prosperity of the town, I assure you, because that's where your money is going, in the sophistication of the major corporations. How they steal money from the town is very sophisticated. You need an attorney general type to look at what's going on and to start recapturing the money and giving it back to the people in the town.
Now, Carl, in looking at this whole scenario and the impact that it has on the workers, let's say that there are just for the sake of argument, let's say there's 300 workers, full-time workers that make one of these Walmarts run in Hopeless, Indiana.
Okay.
And they decide that at the end of whatever their tax abatement period is, that they're going to move the facility to the next town over so they can begin anew again with tax abatements and maybe saturate a different market area. And they, because of this action and the fact that they're basically just shutting down the business, all these jobs are lost, and now you have people who have been counting on those jobs, and it's not due to any of their negligence or their inability to perform to the standards that keep the business operating, but it can be proven that Walmart or whatever that business is, that their intention was merely to avoid paying taxes or avoid complying with their original agreement. Are there any torts? Are there any remedies available to those workers?
The answer is absolutely yes, but let me explain about a lawsuit, because
okay.
Having the idea as you do, and we're discussing the idea right now,
mm-hmm.
is just the beginning of the real problem that exists. The problem that exists is having a complaint that can survive a motion to dismiss. If you can have a very skilled pleading, where a lawyer that writes the pleading called a complaint, it's done very with skill, with the elements of the different claims or causes of action spelled out. Like fraud, for example, has 7 elements. And many lawyers that aren't that experienced, who just happen to prepare a complaint and aren't doing it regularly, might just put down the word fraud, that you defrauded me and you owe me money. But that complaint will be stricken by the court and thrown out. The case will be thrown out. With fraud, you have to be very clear. You have to plead fraud with particularity as to exactly what was said to make it fraudulent.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have a statement of fact that was material, and that if the statement of fact was false when made, and it was made knowing that it was false for the purpose of inducing you to rely, and that you did rely, sometimes you have to allege reasonably, sometimes in some jurisdictions you don't, and that you were injured as a consequence of your reliance. Now, those are the elements of fraud.
Okay.
And for each different cause of action that you claim that you have against a major retailer, for example, or any other person you're suing, you have to understand what is your legal claim, the Robinson-Patman Act. Then you look up the statute and you extract the elements from cases that have decided cases under that statute, from decisions that have been under that statute. So you work your way through each and every claim. You have misrepresentation, you have as a main one, you have breach of contract, you have the implied warranty of good faith and fair dealing, which is a breach of contract type of claim. So you have different legal theories, and then you have to just apply it with each of the elements and spell it out in the complaint. And if you do that, then when a federal or a state judge looks at the complaint, they're going to say, aha, this complaint I'm going to allow to go into discovery and then trial. And at that point, you are likely to settle. They will take a shot at trying to dismiss the case. And if they can't dismiss it, then because the thing was well pleaded, then you have the probability of getting settlement for the people in the town. So a well pleaded complaint is everything in a lawsuit. It is the most important aspect of a lawsuit, having a proper pleading, having it done right. and you need somebody with skills across the board in different disciplines than apply generally in a small town. It's a Wall Street type of practice that you need. You've got to bring that down to the level of a small town and give them a Wall Street lawyer who can handle these varied federal and other related state issues. Like New York has an antitrust law that parallels the federal antitrust law, except we don't have the Robinson-Patton Act. But the state law in the Sherman Act is held to be word for word the same, even though the statutes are different. The courts have said that we'll go with whatever decisions the feds do, we'll go along with that. California, on the other hand, does have a Robinson-Patton Act. So there's different state laws, but the federal law is uniform throughout the country. You have a Robinson-Patton Act that prohibits people from selling in interstate commerce to competitors at different per unit prices, but they're doing it all over the place. And the result is that small business is being driven out of business, but even the manufacturers that participate get driven out of business. So we have to enforce our laws, and the government isn't doing that. So who is going to do it? And I say we ought to do it at the small town level.
Yes. Now, I have another issue I'd like to bring up here.
Sure.
Actually, we're going to take a break here. And when we come back from that break, I'd like to bring this up. And something that's occurring on a state level, but in a local sense. So I'll explain that more when we come back to Evident Footprints.
Maybe a hopeless sense.
Yes. Okay, folks, you're listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com, and our special guest, Carl Pearson, and I, Don Nikoloff, will be right back. Don't go away.
Newspaper, in its ninth year of addressing issues that affect all freedom-loving Americans, is one of the few remaining newspapers courageous enough to print the truth. Concerned about the burgeoning national debt and the Orwellian police state growing up around you? Subscribe today. Only $25 for 12 monthly issues, the Idaho Observer prints what you need to know to be a fully informed American. Go to Idaho-Observer.com or call 208-255-2307.
Ago when I was 23, I was married to a widow who was pretty as could be. This widow had a grown-up daughter who had hair of red. My father fell in love with her and soon they two were wed. This made my dad my son-in-law and changed my very life. For my daughter was my mother because she was my father's wife. To complicate the matter, even though it brought me joy, I soon became the father of a bouncing baby boy. My little baby then became a brother-in-law to Dad. So became my uncle, though it made me very sad. For if he was my uncle, then that also made him brother to the widow's grown-up daughter, who of course was my stepmother. I'm my own grandpa. I'm my own grandpa. It's a funny, I know, but it really is so. Oh, I'm my own grandpa. My father's wife then had a son who kept him on the run. He became my grandchild because he was my daughter's son. My wife is now my mother's mother, and it makes me blue. Because although she is my wife, she's my grandmother too. If my wife is my grandmother, then I am her grandchild. And every time I think of it, it nearly drives me wild.
This has got to be the strangest thing I ever saw.
As husband of my grandmother, I am my own grandpa. I'm my own grandpa. Everybody!
our second segment of Evident Footprints on this October the 21st or the 22nd, depending on what part of the country you're listening. Carl, you got to hear my favorite song there about these genealogies of these.
Oh, I enjoyed that song. I haven't heard it in many, many years.
It's so true, though, you know. It really is. Very prophetic songs. Well, we were discussing the issue of hopeless Indiana. And I'd like you to contemplate something here. This is an actual fact that I'm aware of in, we'll say, in Hopeless, Indiana. Hopeless has a Department of Transportation, which is part of the state. And the people who hire the, let's say, the roadside rest workers, and Seth, by the way, if you're listening, Seth, I've got an echo problem. If you can adjust the audio for me, I'd appreciate that. The workers are hired from another country. Now, I was told that they got a new set of workers that do the cleanup at these roadside rests, the gas stations, the restrooms, the facilities where one stops to take a break when they're driving down the highway. We're paying fees to travel on turnpikes, and they used to hire Mexican workers. And I was told that now they're hiring Ukrainian workers. And I said, what? Would you elaborate a little bit? And they said, well, the Mexican workers that we hired, and these were people from Mexico that were imported into the country for the purpose of acquiring low-cost labor cleaning these facilities, the Mexicans were not doing the job that was expected, so they got rid of them and replaced them with Ukrainians. And it was explained to me that they're much better workers, and that's why they hired these Ukrainians. Don't we have any recourse about who actually gets these government jobs? Shouldn't they be offered to Americans?
There's a big scam that has been going on for many years now, and it's in the visas, and lawyers are participating in this to some extent. But when And Microsoft, for example, has hired maybe, I'm guessing, 20,000-30,000 of these people. Any company that wants to hire people at a lower wage pretty much is allowed to do so by importing these people on a visa where the employer says that we don't have anyone qualified that we can find in America to take this job, and we have to fill it. So we are asking for permission to give a visa to this person in the Ukraine to come to America and be a transportation consultant. They might call the title of cleaning toilets transportation consultant. And they're supposed to give that person the same wage. They're not allowed to import these people and give them a lower wage. They are obligated to, but never do, at least seldom do, give them the prevailing wage for people with that type of job. They only import them to give them a lower wage and thereby drive down the wages generally in America. And this has been going on. It's a political issue, but this is what's happening to some extent, where they have lawful people being imported illegally, or you have others that are jumping over the border illegally to take the jobs. There, generally speaking, you have governments or other people hiring independent companies that hire illegally. For example, Walmart was found to have hired a cleaning company to go in at the end of the day and clean up using illegal aliens who are paid much less than the Americans or the legal people would want. So Walmart and the others that do that say, well, don't blame me. I just hired a contractor who gave me a favorable price. He said he's going to charge me $5 an hour for work. Now, I don't know that they're going to use illegal aliens. Well, at $5 an hour, you should know something, right? I mean, if you're only paying $5 an hour or $7 or $8, you got to figure that the worker is only getting $4. So they can figure it out from the price that something illegal is going on. But there has been no movement to stop it because people in America are given the opportunity of buying goods at less, at a lower price. And they don't want to stop that, even though it cuts their own throats in the process. They don't realize that when they go in and get a lower price today, that means that their neighbor is out of a job. It means their home is, the next door neighbor's home is going to go in foreclosure. It's going to adversely affect your own real estate price. It's going to deteriorate the quality of jobs in the area. You're going to be offered less, and you're going to be sinking lower and lower and more dependent upon getting the lowest price in town as you sink into your death spiral.
Mm-hmm. Well, then my question is, on the basis of this highway interchange being in the district of Hopeless, Indiana, those jobs could be made available to people from Hopeless or in that general vicinity. Is there legal recourse to stop this from happening?
There's three things at least that I see here. Number one, there may be a state or county rule that says that anyone that works has to be working at a prevailing wage. That's one. Number two, you may have the Ukrainian illegal visa situation that you could expose in a lawsuit, or you may have the illegal immigrant problem. So I see those three different areas as a way of getting into the issue legally and being able to stop the process. If, on the other hand, what they're doing is legal, then that's a different story. But I see these three ways that they could do it illegally. And there probably are other ways to consider. But if what they're doing is legal, then I don't know. I mean, my job is to try to figure out why something is illegal if it is. And I've offered three different ways the three different techniques that I can see immediately for which there may be some illegality. And there probably is.
Yes.
So that's actionable. Those things are actionable. You can move for injunctions to stop the process, move for a recovery of the money that was illegally saved by the employer that was doing that, by the firm that hired illegally and used them. There's all sorts of recovery potential here for the people who lost their jobs. Maybe the town could create a fund that will benefit the entire town in ways that you and I have discussed.
Mm-hmm.
So
I definitely see an issue there. You know, generally speaking, the turnpike is probably or any of the toll roads are the better kept of the highway system. And yet, as they raise the fees, they're reducing the costs to the detriment of the public. In other words, I'm paying the higher toll fee. I'm entitled to see better work being done. and I'm going to presume that a local worker that has a job and is able to feed his family, an American, is first entitled to have the job in America instead of giving it away to someone illegally entering the country and stealing the job with the complicity of the politicians.
You know what happens when they bring it up to a vote in Hopeless or some other place? They offer it this way. Which would you rather have, a contract for $1,000 a week or a contract at $5,000 a week that you're going to have to pay for? That's the Walmart problem, and it holds true with using substandard labor, that people, when given a chance to vote on something, are going to choose the lower price. So we have to enforce law in order to take away that choice that tears apart a community. You need law enforcement to prevent the self-interest from destroying the town.
Yes, yes. In the case of the highway, I don't see anything being improved other than they're pocketing more money on their end, and while they're charging us more money to use the road. That's the point I'm making.
Well, the road is being done more cheaply, but doing so, it brings in other problems. You have people that are going to be going on the dole at public expense, getting a lower rate that they can live on, and you're going to have additional costs as a result. So that the immediate cost, in comparing a legal contract with an illegal contract, no one is really looking at the other costs that are going to be met when you have a group of illegals coming into town and performing work in order to give you that $1,000 contract. There's going to be other costs that are going to be imposed on the community. If you just enforce the law, you're not going to have that choice. And it's going to be the right thing to do is to enforce the law. That's what the purpose of these laws is.
Yes.
You want laws that have a purpose, not laws that try to enforce monopolies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. That's why I brought that issue up. And I'm sure if we looked closer, there are probably many other places where the same thing is going on. We probably see this happening at our ports of entry. Definitely, I can tell you that there have been scams for over 100 years right at the INS itself, allowing people to illegally enter the country with false documents or no documents, where there's total obfuscation of the record of entry.
But, you know, the public has not wanted that flow of immigrants shut off, basically, because they came in and picked the strawberries and did other things that gave us a lower cost of food. We want lower cost of food, so we put up with the illegal immigrant thing. It's a political problem that that probably can go back to Rome and explain how Rome failed. You know, if there's a lot of reasons that Rome ultimately failed, and I think part of it was that they had slave labor coming in, and ultimately they had so much of that the slave labor took over, maybe. And I'm not sure about that. I haven't looked at it in many years, but we have to be careful of giving away our system when we try to make it easy on ourselves and only be the rulers and have everyone else do our work for us. We then become a different country. We were, for a long time, a hard-working country, and many people still are hard-working. But we have a ruling group that sort of makes us their slaves and brings in all sorts of other people to make their profits higher. And in doing so, they cheapen the country for most of the people here, as the profits go higher and higher and higher. And we need to stop that, and I think we can do it at the local level.
Yes. I would look at farm subsidies as another issue, paying farmers to not grow crops or ordering them not to grow crops and paying them as a means through which to enforce it, and then complain about having food shortages. And you know, with this issue that you're talking about, the cheaper labor, we get the privilege of E. coli on our food or any other number of communicable diseases. And they can't guarantee the safety or the quality of the food, which is ultimately we have to eat the food, do we not? And if it's not safe to eat, if it's not being properly grown and properly handled, that they should be forced to comply with that as well.
China has a terrible problem of trying to maintain any kind of enforcement like that. You have a lot of corruption at the local level, and it's just hard to oversee a massive country like that. I guess it's difficult, likewise, to do that here. But in China, they put poisons in the food in some areas because it's cheaper. It mixes well, looks good, and they just don't care or don't realize. They don't have as well-developed system as we do, and yet it's said to be the most important factor in antitrust law is the price. And that's an unfortunate ruling that has developed over the years, that price is everything. How about jobs? Why don't we include jobs in the analysis of whether something is good or not? We don't have that under antitrust law. The issue is price, not a question of whether we lose jobs.
Yes.
Somebody has to rethink that, and maybe if Obama gets in or somebody that's forward-looking, they'll start changing the laws and not have price be everything. Because with price being everything, then we should have all of our goods made in China and have no jobs here. It's a fallacy to say that everything should be made at the cheapest place.
Yes.
Because we're not going to be the cheapest place, not with our cost, our overhead cost of maintaining this country. We have to have higher prices here. And we
well,
need jobs.
That there would be no argument if we knew, number one, that the jobs are going to remain here. It's kind of crazy that any price is not affordable if people don't have the money to pay for the goods. It doesn't matter if it's a dollar or if it's 80 cents. If you don't have a job and you don't have income, then you can't buy either product at either price.
Classic analysis says that is the people that argue these antitrust cases are professors that are paid by the establishment to think up reasons why what they're doing is good. So what they say basically is that we try to buy where there's an advantage, so that every country has its own advantage. And China, you have people that work for a very low price. And I'm trying to think that, you know, actually we're going to become another China pretty soon. We're going to be having people here working at a very low price in order to stay alive. So they're really ruining the country by that doctrine that lowest price is the best for the country. It isn't best for us. It's obvious that it's not the best. Anyone is an idiot that says it's the best. But it is the doctrine of the country that the lowest price is where we have to decide our cases, that if somebody can do it at a lower price, then we should be able to buy there, and that will benefit the country. It doesn't. It benefits a few corporations. It doesn't benefit me. It doesn't
Yes.
benefit you, but it does definitely benefit the big corporations.
Yes,
so
that's obvious.
The whole policy was for them, not for us.
Yes. Now, we have a major crisis with the housing industry. And short of going into the games that the banks are playing and the finance companies, the mortgage companies, the title companies, and on down the line, there are instances within the infrastructure of how developers, contractors, for example, these home builders get financed. Just for sake of argument, let's say they give a developer $100,000 per unit to build houses in a particular area, and they're predetermining what the market value of those homes will be, and because the cost of the goods used to make the houses is constantly going up because they're playing games with the prices of oil, which increase the transportation costs of the raw products and then the shipping of the finished products used to build the home. By the time the home is near to completion, it's still not sold. They still have to find a buyer for the house. And a lot of these banks, and I know this has been going on for a number of years, it's been going on since the early 1970s at least, where they're kiting these loans so that the contractors don't have to come up with the money that they don't have, and they get a little bit more money to finish these houses, and now the house becomes more expensive, more difficult to buy. In other words, it's narrowing the market, and we are paying really more money just because all down the line, these companies, these monopolies are profiting by raising prices. And is there any recourse that we have as consumers in hopeless Indiana to stop this type of thing from happening?
Well, let's take, I know, let's say, in New York. I have to talk about New York because I know more law in New York than I do in any other state. In New York State, as an example, we have a statute that says that the Attorney General is permitted to bring an action to stop price gouging, where somebody takes advantage of a short supply and to take away the excess profits from them. We have a statute that permits the Attorney General to bring a suit like that. So that would be one possibility to consider. The question that you said, you've mixed the monopoly of oil. And it's not really a monopoly. It's a group of, well, I guess OPEC to a great extent.
Well, it's a cartel.
Yeah. But the people that build homes and the people that, and the banks that finance them really, that isn't a classic monopoly. You just have one of the problems is that these projects take a year or more to complete, and they start them off and they start digging, and then things get bad, and you question whether you want to stop the process because it may make the neighborhood depressed to have a lot of holes in the ground of unfinished homes. So you really, the community probably would want unfinished homes to be built. And whatever technique works, you really should have a write-off at some point. The homes may not have increased value, and the builders may have to take a hit, but if they do, then they go into bankruptcy, it ties up the property, and I can see, problems along the way, because if you go into bankruptcy with a builder, the homes may wind up not getting built over a longer period, and that will help to deteriorate a community. I don't know, I have to hear more before I can think of some remedy here.
Mm-hmm.
I think banks themselves are a real problem. I would like to have local banks where the money stays here, and the money and the investment by the bank is made with people they know, and they don't participate in this subdivision, the cutting up of a mortgage into a million pieces and sending it out throughout the world as they are with the securitization, the monetization, or the securitization of these mortgages, where they sell tranches or cuts of these mortgages to different investment groups, and you lose the right of any one person to be interested in having the well-being of the person that occupies a specific home. The banks used to care. Now they don't care. They just get rid of the mortgage. They take their profit. Even though the mortgage is bad, toxic, the banks have taken their profit. They paid their huge salaries to the president based on toxic profits.
Mm-hmm.
And then the banks are hurting, so you and I now have to go back and finance them again, and we have to see these banks becoming larger and larger at a point when all of us know that bigness is no longer the best thing, that it costs money. Every time you hear big, that means we have another round of bailing out. Big means bailout at some point in the future. Why do we allow this? We should take as a country and view right now and look at each industry and determine if this company cannot be allowed to fail, then we ought to figure out a way to break it up, because that in itself is injurious to the country as much as a monopoly. Much more so. Well, maybe it's the same. Maybe it's part of the same problem. But if a bank is so large that it can't go under, then we ought to split it up before it goes under.
Yes. Now, the reason I brought up this issue in particular in terms of a builder, whether it's a general contractor or a developer, in banking, if you or I kite checks, they have laws to prevent us from doing that. Yet they kite the loans for these builders, and I've had bank personnel describe this to me, where they call up the borrowers, these developers or these contractors, and tell them, look, we're having an audit, we're calling these particular loans. We know you're not finished with your project, and that we don't really have time to wait. We have to move on this. You're behind in your payments, or we're in a situation where we have to come up with the cash to do this. The only way we can avoid calling the loan due is to rewrite it. And so they tack on another $10,000 or $50,000 to the original loan. And that,
back
that
end, probably, and that gets tacked on to the property.
Yes, exactly. Now, this is being done to us. Is there something we can do to guarantee at the time that that property, based on the price per unit, has been granted by the local authorities when they figure out the zoning and this project, which may have received local, state, and federal funds to assist in the whole process? Is there any way to hold them to that original figure? And that
would say that you
would
want to have a contract somewhere along the way guaranteeing that those who would make the profit are going to guarantee that the homes will be sold at a certain price, and then that would be enforceable.
Mm-hmm.
But if we don't have those contractual promises or guarantees, then we find that somebody would be getting additional government money and still be allowed to jack up the price of the property. I think it's a question of the approval of a prospective builder to try to make sure that is an issue that's thought out and put into the contract and have a guarantor. But that having a guarantor might very well increase the price of the property by 2 or 3%, just having a person guarantee that the property can be resold for that amount. I mean, we're talking now about those same instruments that are causing devastation to the economy.
Yes.
To try to guarantee that a price won't go up. They would sell instruments throughout the world of ensuring that the town is not going to have a higher price for its houses, and there would be these instruments bought in Germany or something that would guarantee that as an investment. So this is where a very complicated economy that we have. But I would say at a minimum you would like to see an agreement as a condition to giving approvals. You would like at that level an agreement that will spell out what amounts can be included in the price of these homes.
Yes. See, I look at this housing issue, and I see properties that to the eye appear to be depreciating because they're not maintained, and yet the values are going up because of the paper that's being written in general in the surrounding areas of those properties. And we need some sort of regulation. It's gone crazy. It's gone wild and chaotic in a sense. And rather than blame the people that have signed the original agreements, if we start fixing all the things that support the income, the basic income cash flow, that people can make their home payments, that these projects do get fixed, because they have to, like you said, if they're in a position where they have to submit to a contract, and that contract is enforceable, then maybe we can begin to stop the corruption that's going on in the banking industry from our level. That's the point I'm making.
I think what you're saying is right, that we're not going to get any statutes. Let's just forget about that. Self-help is what we need. And the private contract, or a town at a minimum, the people in the town insisting that no approvals be granted without these conditions set forth in the contract. If you have these conditions in the contract, then you could have the homeowner enforce it. So that's what you want, is you want a contractual. That's like our own private statute. A contract is a private statute. Mm-hmm. So we can have our own little statutes that can regulate it if they're properly drafted. It's like a complaint. If you don't have a well-drafted contract, you're not going to have the protection.
Yeah.
The same way.
So you like that idea then?
Oh, it's great. Yes. Oh, absolutely. It's a great idea to ensure that these issues of most concern and other issues are implemented by a contract in which the authority to move forward with those homes is coupled with certain conditions.
And then you could even extend that to the local banks, the local lenders. In other words, this is the agreement that...
You don't extend it because they're stuck with it. They have to come in under those conditions.
Yes.
They may not like it. They may charge more for it, but that's part of the problem. But there's always a cost of everything you try to do.
Yes.
But it's worth it, though. I mean, I'm not saying that it's not worth it. It's just... It's well worth it. I think the cost of 5% of the economy, if it were used to pay for all of the expenses of running for office and that nobody was allowed to raise money running for public office, would be a well-spent 5%. It'd allow honest people to run for office who aren't obligated to the rich.
Well, when I compare that and that small inconvenience for any American, really, when you look at the fact that we could probably each own a $400,000 house on the basis of what this bailout is costing us right now, it certainly would be worth it.
Oh, absolutely. And it wouldn't cost 5%, but even if it did, I think 5% of the whole pie devoted to maximizing the value of the pie is well worth it.
Yes. Well, that gives us another thing to talk about in the future, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, now, I wanted to touch on something that you brought up the last time you were on the air, and I've actually gotten a few emails about this from the listeners. And that's the concept of having a local university in Indiana. I almost said Arkansas.
Oh, Arkansas, right.
Hopeless could be in any town, couldn't it? Or in any state.
It will be at some point in almost any town or within any area. And the idea of a tuition-free college or even a very low-tuition college, how about a package of cigarettes a day? That's really the price which has to be covered either by the technique that I use in order to create a tuition-free college, or let the students pay $1,000 or $2,000 a year for the college education if we don't want to go the route of making it tuition-free. Either way is good. The problem, this college is an equivalency college which is slimmed down and all the fat is eliminated. And the fat that's eliminated is tenure of the professor. You know that the Harvard Law professor earns $2,000 an hour to teach?
My goodness, that's just incomprehensible.
They teach 3 hours a week, and they teach 16 weeks in a semester. That's 48 hours for half a year, 96 or 100 hours for the full year. And let's say they make $200,000. Plus, they have free secretaries, free Xerox, free office, free labor, free a lot of things, telephone and whatever. But just the basic salary of, say, $200,000 a year for a professor of law at Harvard Law School, I'm assuming he or she gets paid that, that's $2,000 an hour. So you have to eliminate that kind of payment. You can't afford that. So I eliminate the student loan, the accreditation, the licensing, the tenure, the campus, the food service, the dormitories, the library. And when you would start eliminating all this, you really can come down to a school at a college level, a college equivalency program, because you can't grant a degree. You're not qualified under state law. You have to be accredited. You have to have licensing and all that, or accreditation and approval to grant the degree, which is a form of license by the state. So setting all that stuff aside, that's where your costs are. Your costs are in the regulatory structure. NYU, fully regulated in that fashion, charges $70 an hour for their students to attend class. For a 50-minute session, you pay $70. That's a lot of money for a 50-minute session. In my school, it would be either free or up to $2 an hour. So that if you take a course of 16 hours in a week, that would be $32 a week for the cost of your instruction. I mean, people can afford that. So
that's less than a carton of cigarettes.
Right. It's not much money. It's something that's very doable. So in Hopeless, we could either charge $2 an hour to get started, which I think is easier. But really, we can cover those $2 an hour in this fashion. People that are 73 years of age or older in the community who are wealthy, who are in good health, and are not overinsured, can offer their insurability into a market that's willing to invest or to purchase life insurance policies of that type. So that if a rich person with no insurance that's in good health, willing to do this, 73 years of age to 83, gives us that insurability, then we will buy the policy at our expense, and after we do, immediately, the policy is worth the amount we put down plus $20,000. Just the day that we signed the policy, we made $20,000. If, on the other hand, you wait for 2 years before cashing in the policy is worth $100,000 after payment of all those expenses during that two-year period. If you wait until the person dies, it's worth $1 million. So let's take 21 policies. Seven we cash now, and we get $140,000. Maybe it's $30,000. I think it's $30,000. I forget the value. It's either $20,000 or $30,000. I think it's $30,000 immediately. It's $100,000 in 2 years, and it's $1 million when the person dies. So with the first seven policies, you take the money now. 2 years later, you get $700,000, and beyond that, you have $7 million coming in. So that's how you can pay the tuition. The tuition is only it's $2,000 a year per student, roughly. No more than that. So that isn't much money. And you can have a perfectly good liberal arts education for that price locally. You can't open the school to outside people. It's really intended only for residents. And it's a fantastic idea, and it can be done in any town or village in the United States. The smaller the town, the more you're going to have to go beyond the town and work out a deal with the surrounding towns. Because you need to have a minimum number of students, and I haven't truly figured it out, but I think 200 students per class year, so maybe 800 students for a four-year. When you phase it in over 4 years, you should have a college equivalency program for about 800 people. But it could be 1,000 or 1,600. It could be something like that. But you can't have it for 10 people, for example, or for 50. I think 50 is not enough. You really probably need 200 or so in that first year to give the variety of courses at 30 students per course. Exceeding 30. So
now,
what you really
now
need,
the main complaint a student would have is the degree at the end of the education. But you're talking about a four-year school at a cost of $8,000 as opposed to $280,000?
Let me ask this. How many people have degrees in the country right now?
I couldn't answer that question.
Roughly, just about, you know, 30%, I'm guessing. I have no idea. I haven't thought this thing through, but out of 300 million people, if you have 30% with degrees, that there may be 100 million people with degrees. That doesn't sound too improper, you know, too outlandish, right?
Mm-hmm.
How many of them would take their degree and hand it in if they could get $200,000 paid back to them?
Probably most of them.
Most of them, right? So maybe the cost of the degree really isn't worth what we're paying for it. What we're paying for. And I see now in the country that the cost of education of the degree granting type is going higher and higher, and the expectations in the employment market are going lower and lower. It's impossible for many people to ever repay the loans with interest that they take out to finance their education of the degree granting type.
And that's part of the bailout right
that's
now
correct.
Too.
That's correct. So we need a different way to instruct people. We need to go back to basics. There's too much $2,000 per hour stuff floating around. We have to go back to basics. And people get hurt by that. People that are now, people, various people get hurt. People that would sell their land to a college for an excessive amount of money. People that would work for a college and have a sabbatical once every 7 years, and not have to work and get paid for the full year. People that get the full summer off instead of most of us that only get 1 or 2 or 3 weeks. They take 2.5 months or 3 months off. So these are perks that have to be eliminated if you're going to have a real low budget school. So I've eliminated all this by just starting at the bottom. All you need really is office space, and you don't even need permanent office space. In Hopeless, you can use available office space and promise that if they ever need it, you'll vacate it in 3 months and find some other place. You only need classrooms and chairs and a blackboard and people to come in and teach, and you need a curriculum of these subjects that are going to be taught. But that's easy to put together.
Mm-hmm.
And once you have the local persons in the businesses and in the area teaching, they're going to know the students. When I was at my school in New York, a college that I went to, the only college willing to take me, I wound up graduating 2.5 years later, and I was offered a job because my professor knew, I guess, the richest person around. He was the largest real estate developer in New York. And I was given an interview in this guy's office on Madison Avenue. He had a replica of the Oval Office of the White House. That was his office. He made a replica of it. And I was interviewed by him in his office, and the guy offered me a job as his personal assistant because my professor knew me and said I would be ideal for that person. So I went over and I was interviewed by him, and I couldn't take the job because I was going to law school, but I at least wanted to go through the interview and see what it was like. So the professors or instructors will get to know the students, and the jobs will be given to those local students, because if you have a local graduate that you know, that you've taught, who doesn't owe any money at all in student loans, and you go up, and that person is going up against a Harvard graduate that owes $150,000. Who would you hire as an employer? The one that you know, that doesn't owe any student loans, who will be happy or happier with the compensation that you're offering? Or do you have a Harvard graduate that comes in and says, my God, I can't even service my student loans with that. I'm going to have to work in two other jobs, a second and a third job. That's an unhappy employee, not one that's going to prosper in the company. I will take the local graduate anytime. So you're going to have really a favorable employment market for those people. And when they get experience and skills, where they went to college really drops out. Like, how many people do you think that I represent know that I went to a specific law school? Do you think they know? Do you think they have any idea what law school I went to? Do you think that I look at these people in the room when I'm doing a deposition today and I wonder what law school I went to? It never crossed my mind. It's not important. I went to the best law school in the country, but nobody cares.
Yes. Well, I can tell you from personal experience that I have interviewed job applicants and people that wanted to work with me in my professional music production business, in either in a recording studio or on a field project, and I would give them a task, a pretty simple task to perform, and these are people that went to a 4-year accredited school, a state university, let's say, and they paid $20,000 or $30,000 a year for an education, and really didn't know the first place to begin doing this simple task. We're talking about booting up a computer and maybe introducing some sound into the computer and working with the sound file, which is ultimately what they're going to be doing every day of the year, and couldn't make heads or tails out of how to begin the process.
Well, I'm not trying to advocate a vocational school. I'm really trying to be comparable to a true liberal arts education, and there's nothing wrong with getting some technique at the same time. Like at law school, it used to be pure theory, but now they have moot courts where you go in and practice trial skills and things like that. So there can be a degree of that, but you really want to have the basics in English, in philosophy, in logic, in history, and so on. You really want that, I believe. I mean, but then that's a local matter that people are going to have to decide that each locality, hopeless and less hope, are going to have to decide that for themselves. But we can bring in a college. We can show them that we don't bring in anything. We don't bring anything except the idea. And the idea is even being broadcast to the nation right now.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody can do this.
Yeah, I use this example, Carl, just to point out that having the degree doesn't necessarily mean you have the skills.
That's
the point I'm making. And that could have, you know, it could be an English class or whatever. I'm just pointing out that if you go through the financial hoops that are required to go through to get that piece of paper, it doesn't necessarily mean that you are qualified to do work in the area of your so-called expertise, your major.
Imagine that Hopeless or any other town that sets up its own 4-year equivalency college can also have a curriculum there to teach people how to bring manufacturing back to the area.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a fabulous thing to have. And it's going to create competition that will allow that town to prosper more than its neighboring towns. It's just got to. The various things that we've talked about that we're implementing in Hopeless are going to make the town a much better place to live. And there will be a demand to move into that area, and that's going to increase the value of the homes. It's going to make the mortgages no longer in default, and we can actually, by this bootstrap operation, we can improve the town dramatically, and Hopeless will become a great place to live in, as it is already, except for the economics.
Yes. Now I would add in our closing moments here, we still have a few minutes. The next phase of this is also something that you've tackled, and that's your MyClad site, where maybe a certain percentage of students are not going to pursue a career in teaching, but they're going to have a skill, whether it's in manufacturing or something related to service or some application of a particular discipline that is going to enable them to open their own business. You've also created a means through which to make it possible for them to find a client base within the community itself.
Yeah, here's basically what happens. When a person gets a job, they then go to a place every day, and they have other people deciding what tasks that new employee is going to perform for the company. But when you really break it down, it's only tasks that we're performing, whether we're performing it for Walmart or for AutoZone or whether we're performing it for ourselves. They're only tasks. So that why don't we just list the tasks that we wish to offer on a website? So I created that website, and I have it. It's called myclads.com. It means myclassifiedadvertisements.com. And people, I'm encouraging them at no cost to list as many different things as you want. There's no limitation that you must list it for your area. I list by zip code, and I have a 50-mile zip code radius search where people can find you up to 50 miles away from where their own zip code is or the one they insert. So that if, for example, and the ads last forever, so that you have an incentive of creating a new financial future for yourself by putting in as many ads as you can think of tasks that you would like to perform for money. If you want to give them away, I don't mind. I'm not telling you what to charge. If you want to give away a task merely to become knowledgeable, that's fine. But you can put on hundreds and hundreds of tasks by keywords. Mow lawns. Tutor quantum mechanics high school level. Assemble IKEA furniture. Milk cows, or for example, consult on bringing back manufacturing to the area, or something like that. All of these are keywords, keyword ads. They can be put on in 5 or 10 seconds, and for every keyword ad, I give you the opportunity of creating a website on your own website, and you put a link in there so that Mow Lawns goes to your website and they see you mowing the lawn. A picture of you, the tools, your price, anything you want. So that way all of us can now participate as where the computer becomes the employer. And you compete with everyone else in the world, but the tools that I offer you are phenomenal. And I think that I can easily bring in $100 or $200 a day for people that think through what to do and put their ads on. And the way this works is this, that if I get 40% of the town, the available people who would like to do this, 40% of the people who are eligible, which is anyone if you want to work, to sign up, I will then start marketing the website within the 25 miles around the website, around the town. And that will be the source of revenue. The people in that outlying area are going to say, hey, why should the people in Hopeless make all the money? I want to join that website. I think the website will then spread throughout the United States and beyond. And we now have a frictionless way of working without a middleman, and there's no payroll tax. There's no payroll deduction. There's no garnishment. People can keep the money that they earn and spend it. Of course, you're going to have expenses. You're in business. But it becomes an employer, a universal employer for people who really are no longer wanted by the bigger corporations. They want to get rid of them and hire persons in other countries. Fine. Let us have our own system of employment here. And that's going to bring in 100 or 200 a day $25,000 or $50,000 a year for participants with no commissions, no brokerage fee, no fees. This is what I'm offering for nothing.
Well, that's a tremendous potential of self-empowerment there for the individual and then collectively the community.
So I see how we can pull Hopeless up and make Hopeless the star town in the United States that every other town is going to follow.
They'll probably have to change the name to Hopeful then. Well, this has been a very interesting show again, Carl, and can we have you back again?
Absolutely, anytime.
I'm sure this is something that we're going to explore more. We'll shoot for some more dates in November. I've yet to put that schedule together, so count on leaving a couple of dates open for us.
Good. Also, I want to thank you publicly for what you've done because you have introduced me to Hopeless, and it's not hopeless at all. It's great hope. Great hope out there because of you and what you've done, your show and you personally. I have to thank you for it.
Well, I'm just doing what any American that's got the eyes to see and the ears to hear would do. And I want to encourage the listening audience to go to your websites, myclads.com, also lawmall. Is that .com also?
Yes, and you and I are willing to do it in any town, anywhere throughout the United States.
Yes. In fact, I'll go out on a limb and offer that within my capacity to help you do that.
Terrific. Thanks.
I know it can be done. I'll say that much to the listening audience. It can be done. And it's a great idea, and it's just a matter of opening that door. If anyone out there would like to see this happen in their area, drop me an email, or even Carl, if you want to give out your email address too, Carl, go ahead.
It's too complicated. It's just lawmall.com or carlperson.com.
Okay.
Carlperson.com, P-E-R-S-O-N, they can find me that way.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Carl, and I know you and I will be talking very soon. So I wish you the best.
Terrific, Don. Thank you very much.
And thank you so much for being on Evident Footprints tonight.
Terrific. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Folks, you have been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com and Carl Pearson of MyClads.com, LawMall.com. He's actually got about 100 websites. Those are a good starting point. And I'd like to thank Don Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, Seth Hendrick for the sound, and most of all, my listening audience for tuning in tonight. You have a night filled with peace, love, and light. We'll see you tomorrow. In the meantime, have a good night.